Tonight on the Daily Debrief, R&B singer R. Kelly appears in court, demanding documents from the prosecutors accusing him of sex crimes. Plus, questions about sloppy police work in the case of a family of four found murdered in the California desert. Did the real killer escape police scrutiny? And horror on the highway. The dramatic dash cam video of the crash which killed five teens. Should the man who caused it go to prison or a mental hospital? This is the Daily Debrief. It's Tuesday, May 7th.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Linda Kenney-Bodden along with me tonight. We're going to be joined by another guest in a moment here. Attorneys for R&B singer R. Kelly appeared in a Chicago courtroom today for a pretrial hearing. Kelly faces 10 aggravated criminal sexual abuse charges involving four victims. Three are underage. Each count carries a possible 3 to 7 year prison sentence. At today's hearing, Kelly's defense asked the state to disclose the names of the victims. That's standard, so the defense can know what Kelly is up against and mount an adequate defense. Kelly's defense team also asked to see communications between attorney Michael Avenatti and the prosecutor's office.
5-9. Is the person they're calling HW who filed a civil lawsuit disclosing her own name. And that's included in here.
Okay.
The other is the case that they're referring to as JP, who wrote a book disclosing her own name. But those are the two cases. What we don't have, and we need still, is we did file a motion for texts, emails, and so forth regarding Mr. Avenatti, the state's attorney's office, mm-hmm. between all of them. Now they said they're going to preserve them, and my understanding is that they're going to be produced.
Okay, here's what we'll do. Talk about it, okay? And then if you can't reach a resolution on that and you feel that that information is relevant, I want you to file a motion.
I did file a motion, Judge.
I know, but you need to supplement it. It was pretty...
Okay.
It wasn't really very specific. It had a lot of generalities, mm-hmm. but I need to know specifics.
Well,
in other words, what do you think that you hope to gain from that for the defense of Mr. Kelly?
Well, Judge, Mr. Avenatti is a witness in the case, so we're entitled to any statements that he made in communicating with
All right.
the prosecutor.
Here's what we're going to do. If you can't work it out with the state, I want you to supplement your motion,
okay.
indicate that in there, and I can give you the opportunity to respond, and that's the way we'll do it.
All right, put it in writing and make it crystal clear. Kelly's attorneys are also asking for access to video said to depict Kelly engaged in a sex act with someone underage. The Georgia Supreme Court today heard arguments in the case of a man accused of killing a beauty queen. Teacher and pageant competitor Tara Grinstead died in October 2005. Alleged killer Ryan Duke today asked the Georgia Supreme Court to find the power to jump into his case before a trial. The defense wants state money for investigators and experts. The trial judge refused those requests. Today's argument centered on whether the Supreme Court even had the power to hear the request at this stage in the proceedings. Court is back in session today in the case of the McStay family murders in California. Defendant Charles Merritt is accused of killing business associate Joseph McStay and the entire McStay family in 2010. The graves of all four of the McStays turned up in the Mojave Desert in 2013. The defense says three unknown DNA profiles on items recovered with the bodies point to three unknown killers and not this defendant. In court today, the defense asked the lead case agent whether authorities were sure that defense alternate suspect Dan Kavanaugh was really in Hawaii or whether that alibi of Kavanaugh's was a lie. Here, the defense asks about a search warrant for Kavanaugh's phone records, which showed calls to Hawaii around the time the McStays disappeared and were likely murdered.
Other than checking with Detective Avila, what else did you do to confirm Mr. Kavanaugh's alibi?
Are you talking later after we interviewed him?
Whenever.
We followed up with Laura Knowles, who was the female that he was in Hawaii with.
And you mentioned that on Friday, right?
Thursday. Yes.
Okay. But did you ask her for any boarding passes or plane tickets or anything like that?
I actually asked and answered on Thursday.
Ooh. You'd have to talk to Detective Henke about that. He was the one that interviewed her.
Okay. Well, you're the case agent. Did you ever come across a ticket or a boarding pass or anything like that?
Not to my knowledge.
And you yourself never contacted any airline or any airport authority or the TSA or anything like that?
I did not.
So, Lauren Knowles' girlfriend, anything else that you did to check the alibi?
Obtained his phone records.
Okay. Now, again, I asked you on Thursday, what is it about his phone records that would provide an alibi for him?
Based on the fact that he says he's there, his phone records indicate that he's calling local establishments there in Hawaii, along with Lauren Knowles' statement and photographs that she provided. We were pretty confident that he was in Hawaii at the time that the McStays went missing.
So his phone records show calls to Hawaii numbers. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so, yes.
So would that require Mr. Kavanaugh to be in Hawaii to make calls to Hawaii numbers?
He asked me that on Thursday. I said no, it wouldn't.
Okay. So other than check his phone records, did you do anything else?
Not that I can recall. Yeah, no.
Okay, so the question for the jury is whether this police work is good enough. Remember, the defense has IP addresses which suggest Kavanaugh was in California near where the murders happened when they happened. Next, the defense asked the lead investigator why he did not confront Kavanaugh about his financial moves related to the McStay business.
So the topic of Mr. Kavanaugh selling the company, did that come up in your interview?
It did.
Okay. Now, since you had information, since you knew that that was Joseph's company at the time that you interviewed Mr. Kavanaugh, did you ever confront Mr. Kavanaugh in this interview and say, how the heck did you sell Joseph's company
objection
without his permission?
Relevance, argumentative.
Sustain this, please.
Did you ever ask Mr. Kavanaugh, how was it that he was able to sell Joseph's company without Joseph's or his family's permission?
Objection, relevance.
Based on the information that's in there, at that portion of there, it didn't look like we confronted him regarding that. There were a lot of questions, obviously, because we had never talked to Mr. Kavanaugh before. So without speaking to Mr. Kavanaugh at that point, we still hadn't even spoke to Mr. Merritt. So Mr. Kavanaugh obviously provided information that Merritt deleted the accounts also that he felt was concerning.
Objection, not responsive. Move to strike.
So you didn't confront him, at least with in what you're looking at in the transcript, correct?
In the portions of the transcript that are reviewed, no.
Okay. And do you recall ever going back after September 20th at any time and asking Mr. Kavanaugh, how is it that you were able to sell EIP without Joseph's permission or his estate's permission?
Objection, relevance, and argumentative.
I didn't re-interview Mr. Kavanaugh after that.
A lot to chew on there. Joining me tonight are attorneys Joseph Tully and Linda Kenny Bodden. So, Joseph, I'll start with you here. A lot of nonstop objections in there through this whole exchange from the prosecution. The state clearly wants to limit what the jury knows about what Dan Kavanaugh said. It seems like it's pretty clear hearsay, but the question is the defense trying to be too sneaky about how it gets Kavanaugh's answers in front of the jury?
I don't think they're being too sneaky. I think a lot of times prosecution, when they object too much, then they look like they're trying to hide. So this might be a tactic of objecting too much that might turn around and bite the person who's objecting.
You know, I wonder that too, but we've got hearsay rules for a reason. Kavanaugh's just saying these things to the police. If they want to cross-examine Kavanaugh, they need to subpoena him and get him up on the stand. That's if they can find him.
Correct, but remember, it's always the government's burden to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. So if there's something that the jury needs for a conviction and the government doesn't provide it, that has to be held against the government.
Linda Kenny Bodden, I'll throw these questions at you here, too. Does the defense need to kind of like firm up these questions, try to get the train back on the tracks here, or what's the best way to kind of move this along?
Well, I do think they are actually doing okay here. Remember, the judge has hamstrung this defense by not allowing the threats that Mr. McStay considered were threats. Obviously, they were on his computer that said, you, Dan Kavanaugh, I really know now what you can do to my family. And the threat, allegedly, that Kavanaugh said, you know, to a neighbor that he could bury him, kill him, bury burying him in a desert, no one would find him for years. So the defense is working around that restriction and trying to still show Kavanaugh was a suspect. I think they're doing a pretty good job, actually.
Okay, so Linda, you know, one thing I'm looking at here is I'm seeing additional serious gaps in the state's case. I'll agree with that. The defense is saying Kavanaugh was lying to police about his PayPal records. And remember, finances are a huge part of this. Right. They're saying that he might be lying about being in Hawaii, that he was there before the murders, but that he came back, that the IP addresses suggest that. You know, calls to Hawaii, numbers that the police didn't check to see precisely where those calls were made, the girlfriend providing the corroboration of the alibi. These things could be investigated a little bit further here.
Yeah, they could be investigated further. Furthermore, you have another big issue here is that this could have been a hit in some way, either Kavanaugh is in on it. And, I could have my phone here and calling. I got a call today from Sierra Leone. That doesn't mean I'm in Sierra Leone, but if I were, I could still call somebody back and say, hey, you know, do that thing I paid you for. You know, so there's a lot of options here for the defense to go in summation.
Okay, that case rolls along, closing arguments possibly as soon as next week. Houston police, meanwhile, say a father who reported his 4-year-old daughter missing is now a person of interest in the case. Malia Davis's father said he was changing a tire when two men drove up in the girl's mother's truck and took her. Police now have been, until now rather, have been unwilling to say whether they believe that story. The father says the abduction occurred Friday, but he did not report the little girl missing until Saturday. And still ahead tonight, here on The Debrief, we take you back inside the Stephen Burgoyne trial in Vermont. Police officers say Burgoyne not only crashed and killed 5 teenagers, but that he tried to escape. The dash cam video in just a moment. Welcome back to The Debrief. This is the case of Horror on the Highway, a Vermont man accused of speeding the wrong way down an interstate and slamming into a car carrying 5 high school students. Stephen Burgoyne is accused of 5 counts of second-degree murder, 1 count of aggravated operation of a vehicle, and 1 count of gross negligence. The victims of that massive, fiery crash were all 15 and 16 years old. None of them survived. And here's where it gets even more shocking. After the first crash, Burgoyne stole a responding police car, took off, turned around, and then caused a second massive crash. Graphic dash cam video today showed the aftermath of that fatal crash. The images included video taken from inside the police car the defendant stole from the scene.
After Stephen Burgoyne struck a car full of 5 teenagers driving the wrong way down the highway in Vermont, he was not done. Dash cam video shows Burgoyne stealing a police cruiser and fleeing the scene. In this portion, we've sped up for clarity. He stops, does a 3-point turn, and drives back to the scene of the first crash. This video stops just before he causes a second massive crash. Eyewitnesses Keith Porter described leaping out of the way to avoid being hit by Burgoyne.
I expected to not survive, and I laid down on the highway and kind of tried to dive towards the median and brace myself.
Porter escaped with minor injuries. The jury next saw dash cam video of the fiery wreckage of the second crash. Eyewitness Susan James described how the normally peaceful evening in the Vermont countryside transformed in an instant.
I mean, it looked like a war zone. It looked like an Armageddon. It looked like, you know, things had blown up.
Finally, the dash cam shows Burgoyne being treated by a doctor on the scene. Here, he even tries to escape. Burgoyne is finally detained and taken away handcuffed to a stretcher. This is Rachel Stockman reporting for the Law and Crime Network.
And today in court, a police officer described the speed of the vehicle Burgoyne was driving.
Ultimately able to determine how fast it was going when it left the first crash scene.
Yes.
And how were you able to do that?
Watching Officer Shepard's video, the cruiser video.
And at some point, were you able to determine that his speed changed?
From the time he stole it and when he turned around, yes.
Okay. So can you tell the jury what speeds he was going when he left the scene and what speeds he was going?
Yep. From the watching the video, looks like he's coming from the median where the car was on fire. Talks to somebody or is up next to the guy with a cell phone, and then you see him run to the cruiser. gets in the cruiser, and at one point he reaches, I think, 81, and then that's just for a second, and then he drops and maintains anywhere between 60 and 65, going southbound in the right direction.
Okay. And can you observe through the video that he stops and turns around?
Yes, you can see him pull over and then turn around, and then he just guns it.
And can you, what do you mean by guns it?
His speed immediately jumped up. It was 50 to 80 within seconds, and he passed me going, I believe it was 95, and at one point, just before the second accident, he's doing 103.
Next, an officer testified about what the defendant was doing shortly after the two massive crashes. This is cross-examination.
The other officer had an individual on the ground, prone on the ground. Do you remember that?
Yes, sir.
And did that person say anything, the person on the ground?
No, not that I recall.
Okay, was he doing anything vocally?
Screaming.
Okay. How did he appear to you? The screaming, how did the screaming make you think he was feeling any particular way, the individual on the ground?
I can't speculate. I heard screaming. I can't really interpret what it meant.
You remember taking a deposition in this case?
I do.
You remember saying that literally just loud noises, he was just, like he was frightened. It wasn't anything where he was saying words, he was just screaming. You remember saying that?
Correct.
Okay, so he was screaming like he was frightened.
Sure.
And another officer described speaking with defendant Burgoyne, then the moment authorities say Burgoyne actually tried to escape.
We kept him in the median, but we had moved him farther away from the Williston cruiser and closer to where my cruiser was positioned in the left lane of travel. So we had brought him, we dragged him, I guess you say, north of the location he was at.
Okay. And did you stay with this individual or did Officer Shepard?
I stayed.
Okay. And did you ask him any questions about what had happened?
Yes.
And what did you ask him?
I asked him if he was involved in the crash, if he was in the car that was in the median, if he was involved in that.
Okay. And so when you're asking him these questions, you don't know the answers, right?
No.
Okay. So you were trying to just get information from him?
Yes.
And did he respond to you?
No.
Okay. Did you ask this person what his name was?
Yes.
How many times do you think that you asked him?
I must ask him 3 to 4 times, at least.
And did he give you his name?
Eventually, yes.
And what did he say that his name was?
Stephen Burgoyne.
Did you take Mr. Burgoyne's handcuffs off at any point during this interaction?
Yes. The doctor asked if I could take the handcuffs off because he said it was making it hard for him to breathe.
Okay. And was he also trying to get his blood pressure?
Yes.
Okay. And so did you, in fact, take the handcuffs off?
Yes.
And how did Mr. Burgoyne respond to having his handcuffs taken off?
He attempted to get up at that point.
Okay. And was he successful?
He did a quick spin, and I think he got up to maybe his knee, but then I was able to get him back onto the ground and put him back in handcuffs again.
An off-duty nurse also testified about this alleged escape attempt.
Yes, the police officer did remove the handcuffs.
Okay. And where were you in relation to the defendant when the handcuffs were removed?
So I was, the physician was towards the head of Stephen. The police officer was right to my right, and I was down below. So if Stephen was here, I was right about here, and the physician was up here, and the police officer was right here.
And so they take the handcuffs off. What happens?
So when they took the handcuffs off, Stephen tried to get up and run.
So tell us what you mean by he tried to get up and run.
So when they took the handcuffs off, he went to get off from the ground and take off again. He tried to get away.
Can you tell us physically what he was doing when he was trying to get away?
He was trying to get himself off the ground.
Okay. Did he actually ever be able to get up and stand?
No, because the police officer quickly pushed him back down to the ground and handcuffed him back.
Okay. And so how did you react to that when that happened?
So I remember saying to the physician, if you handcuff him, or if you ask to unhandcuff him again, I said, I am not going to be helping with this because I didn't know what he was capable of doing.
Okay, let's run through Vermont's rather loose standard for an insanity defense here before we bring in a discussion. Burgoyne has the burden of proving his own insanity by a preponderance of the evidence. In other words, that it was more likely than not that he was legally insane. Here's the standard for that. Burgoyne must prove that he lacked the adequate capacity to either appreciate that his conduct was criminal or to conform his conduct to the law. So back to the panel now. Linda Kenny-Bodden, Joseph Tully. Joseph, insanity or something else on this case?
I think the evidence weighs heavily in favor, especially given this legal standard of insanity in this case.
Linda Kenny-Bodden, what do you make of it?
Well, you know, he's going to have a mental disease or defect because he sought treatment, and there's going to be a doctor that's going to say for that, saw him for the state that he had a mental disease or defect. But I don't think, even with that loose standard, that it will fly before the jury. I think the jury is going to find that because he tried to run, because he got in the police cruiser, because he knew his hip was hurting, because he was screaming, that he didn't think that people dealing with him were aliens. He thought that he was mad, angry, and he was going to do what he wanted to do.
You know, yesterday I sat in this chair, Linda, and I said, okay, you know, I think this is a strong case for an insanity defense. It's easy to get it in Vermont. I was reading the case law. A lot of defendants try it. They throw a fit when their lawyers don't try it on their behalf because it's relatively easy to get. And now I'm starting to change my mind a little bit. I'm saying, wait a minute. He was talking to witnesses saying he lost control. Joseph, what do you think of this? So he's talking about that. He's stating his name, and he got up and tried to run. That sounds like he could, under the letter of the law, appreciate that his conduct was criminal or conform his conduct to the law.
I don't know. It could also be used to establish that he couldn't conform his conduct. In other words, why would you, at the scene of a crime, take a police cruiser? He got away scot-free. Like, he could have kept driving. He could have stopped at any point in time and ran into the woods and, you know, gotten away. That's what he was doing. That's what he would have done if he was, you know, guilty trying to flee. On the other hand, he turned around and drove back and then tried to, you know, perhaps plow into people the second time. So there's the actions are bizarre in this case. And when it's bizarre, but it doesn't make sense, that supports insanity.
So much to go over in this case. Hey, we've got to wrap things up. Thanks a lot for joining us, Joseph Tully, Linda Kenny-Bodden. We'll be back tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern live right here on the Law and Crime Network with The Debrief, our recap of the best moments legally nationwide. We'll see you tomorrow.